ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to the Foreign Correspondents Club. My name is Keith Bradshaw. I'm the Hong Kong Bureau Chief for the New York Times, and I'll be your host today on behalf of the FCC Board of Governors. Before I introduce our guest today, please, everybody, turn off your cell phones now, or at least mute them. We now get, in some cases, thousands of people watching on YouTube our presentations, and we hear about it from our members and others if somebody's phone prevents them from hearing exactly every word of our speaker. I'd like to mention just briefly, we have another very good event coming up. We have Ronnie Chan coming up this Thursday, speaking about the Hong Kong property market. That'll be our next event coming up. I believe there's already a waiting list for that, but if you want to add your names to that, you're welcome to do so. With that, our speaker today, what subject could be more important, not just for the Foreign Correspondents Club, but for Hong Kong, than freedom of speech? Like, all of us here have been very concerned about what has happened to the five booksellers, particularly the most recent to disappear. Somebody who, after all, had told the South China Morning Post that I feel safe as long as I stay in Hong Kong, and then mysteriously disappears without even taking his right of return permit. And after a week of inquiries, even the Hong Kong government can't seem to figure out where he is or get an answer on where he is. The question of freedom of speech then also comes to what kind of data is available and how readily available is that? So much of the proper functioning of financial markets depends on people being able to know who is really who has done what are the transactions that are out there. And few people have done more to try to keep the financial markets honest in Hong Kong and been outspoken about it than David Webb. So we're very honored to have him here today. Thank you all for coming.
Thank you, Keith, for that very kind introduction. It's a pleasure to be back at the FCC. I think the last time I was here was to talk about preserving access to ID card numbers in the Hong Kong Companies Registry, a battle that we, at least for now, have won because the government withdrew the subsidiary legislation that it was due to table in the Legislative Council. But the battle to make more information public, the need for example, a freedom of information law rather than a toothless code on access to information that you currently have to work with as journalists, the need for an archives law so that the government actually keeps the embarrassing minutes of decisions that are made that can then be exposed to historical and academic analysis, hopefully 25 or 30 years' time from now. These things are ongoing. We still have no archives law. We have no freedom of information ordinance. And if anything, things are heading the other way. While other companies' registries around the world are opening up, and if you go to the UK Companies House, you can now get every document since 1996 for free from the cloud. In Hong Kong, there's been no action in that direction. And I think, as Keith said, that the data information is the lifeblood of our way of life in Hong Kong, and the right to express yourself freely is part of that. And this is actually something that is part of the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights. You will have heard a lot about that in the context of universal suffrage, but it's also, with the exception of the universal suffrage provision, which was carved out, Hong Kong has adopted the International Covenant into its Bill of Rights, word for word. And the Covenant says that in Article 17.1, no one shall be subjected to arbitrary or unlawful interference with his privacy, family, home, or correspondence, nor to unlawful attacks on his honor and reputation. So that's one right that needs to be protected by the government and through legislation. But it also says that everyone shall have the right to freedom of expression, and that's a two-way right. You might not think of it that way. Normally, it's just about freedom of speech, but it's also about your right to seek, receive that information as well, to obtain it from public sources, to obtain it from people who have obtained it from public sources in the future. and this is where the talk will focus today. Whether it's orally, whether it's on a website, whether it's over a drink, where I can tell you something that I've learned from a public document, or whether it's on a website. But of course, there has to be some compromise between rights that may conflict in constitutions or in bills of rights. And so Article 19.3 says that these rights carry special duties and responsibilities, and therefore they may be subject to certain restrictions, but no more than is necessary. And that's a key word, necessary, to respect the other rights, and for the protection of national security or public order. And there, of course, we stray into issues like Article 23 and into the laws on libel and defamation, which provide some restrictions on what you can freely say, and it varies in different countries. So our Bill of Rights was enacted in 1991 in the Bill of Rights Ordinance. It binds only the government. Remember that. You're not obliged as a private citizen to uphold these rights. It's the government that is supposed to protect you through legislation and policy. In our basic law, we also have the freedom of speech, of the press, and of publication. And the basic law also refers to the bill, to the Bill of Rights, the ICCPR. It shall remain in force after the 1997 handover. Now, I'm going to talk about the public domain, but I don't mean the freedom to play Mozart's compositions. I'm not talking about the Copyright Amendment Ordinance either. That's not the context. I'm talking about public domain in facts. There's no copyright in facts. It's information that has been published, or more specifically, it's been legally published. Information that you might collect from a company's registry document, from a court judgment, from a newspaper. it's once it's out there, it's like the arrow of time in physics. It's not reversible. The information has been published. I don't believe it can be unpublished. Let me grab it. You might wish that sometimes it could be unpublished. Almost anything that goes through the courts is embarrassing to somebody if it's bankruptcy or litigation or criminal prosecution, but it's out there. Now, we do have privacy laws in Hong Kong, a law. Most developed countries have a privacy law. And there's a good purpose to them. It's to prevent your private information from becoming public. Even the United States, which doesn't have a specific privacy law, does have laws on protection of health data. For example, the HIPAA Act makes sure that hospitals and doctors keep your medical records private. Likewise, bank records should be kept private. Your school test results should be kept private. That's the intent of the privacy provisions, and the rights against interference and bugging your telephone and so on in communications. But I don't think that should extend to information which has been legally published. You can't make public data private. It's impractical to tell people to forget what they've learned, not to repeat it. If you try to do that, you create basically what George Orwell called in 1984 memory holes. You have a society of people who have the information, and people who don't have it and are not allowed to learn it from those who do. So the privacy laws exist for a good purpose, but we don't and shouldn't try to create a two-tier society of those who know and those who don't. Now, this came to a head in Europe in the famous case of Google versus Spain. A gentleman called Mario Constella González failed to pay his taxes, and his property was foreclosed. This was announced by a statutory notice in the La Vanguardia newspaper, which later appeared on their website once they went online, in their archive. And he later repaid the debt that related to the foreclosure notice. And so he wrote to the Spanish Privacy Commissioner and said, please remove, order the newspaper to take this out of its archive, and also order Google to stop linking to the newspaper. And the commissioner ruled that the newspaper did not have to tear up its archive and remove pages from the image files of each page in the newspaper that contained this notice, But they did say that Google should remove the links so that in practice you won't find it unless you happen to know which page of which newspaper on which date the notice appeared in which case you probably don't need the newspaper, you've already got it. So Google appealed to the European Court of Justice. Before the court ruled, they had something, they had an opinion given to them by one of their executive staff who said basically that Google was right, but the court ruled that Google was wrong and thereby created effectively the so-called right to be forgotten, which Google is now grappling with, and so are other search engines in Europe. And incidentally, Mr. Gonzalez and his tax problems are now famous. He's probably the only person who was still aware of them until he started complaining, and that's known as the Streisand effect. These are the notices from the Vanguardia in 1998. These slides will be online later. If you want to click on the links, you can find the originals. And this is Barbara Streisand's house. The Streisand effect is so named because there was a couple who were conducting surveys of coastal erosion along the California coastline, and they took pictures at 100-meter intervals or whatever. They didn't know whose homes they were, but Barbara Streisand found her house on this survey, and up until the point she filed her legal action, the picture had only been downloaded 5 times, including 3 times by her lawyers. It's famous, and we all know exactly where she lives. So that's the picture, and click on the link, you could find the original page on the Coastal Survey website. It's still there. Now, the consequences of the Google versus Spain ruling are that Google and all the other search engines, they have now a list of what we don't know. They have, in Donald Rumsfeld speak, the known unknowns. I think in a great position of power because they have to decide, at least within the EU, which requests for takedowns to accept and which ones to reject. That's a major expense to them, but they're a multi-billion-dollar company that can afford it. It certainly provides a barrier to entry for new search engines if you have to immediately staff up a takedown department the moment you start indexing the web. But they've had 400,000 requests already for takedowns, and they've granted about 40% of them, because the alternative, of course, is waiting for a complaint from the Privacy Commissioner in each country from the person whose request was rejected. The European Court of Justice said that whether a link should be removed depends on the time elapsed, they didn't say how much time, and the role played by the data subject in public life. So if you are a high-profile pop star or a politician, maybe there's a greater interest in your affairs than if you're not a public figure. Anyone, in theory, can build their own search engine. The government has plenty of resources. It could be running a search engine on the web right now. We wouldn't know it. The NSA certainly does. And so the NSA knows everything that Google knows and more. They know what the public doesn't. Now, in that case, before you run for public office, file your complaints with Google in Europe, ask them to take down the embarrassing information about your drunk driving conviction, that's spent, your bankruptcy, you're no longer bankrupt, or your the report about your wife beating or husband beating, or the fake doctorate that you might have before you run for legislative council, for example. Google has to decide, is it still relevant? Who is it still relevant to? If it's not relevant to anyone, then why does it matter if it stays online? It also creates a question of what do you do about search functions on websites? If you go to the Daily Mail website and search for a name, they've got millions of old articles that they search on their own site. Do they have to run a takedown facility to remove search results from their own little search box on their page? The court didn't deal with that. The court also didn't deal with what happens overseas. But how hard would research be for you as journalists, for academics, as researchers, if they didn't have access to all that we have today, all the archives, of public information and contemporary discussion on important political decisions. It was George Santayana, the philosopher, who said in 1905 that those who cannot remember the past are condemned to repeat it. Outside the EU, Google doesn't censor results, but recently, in the end of last year, they had a battle with France, and the commissioner there has ruled that they must also censor their overseas Google.com, not just Google.co.fr in France. It's not clear whether they're going to comply with that, because, of course, it means if they take down search results from Google.com in the United States, then people in the United States who have nothing to do with France can't find the information about the names concerned. So is there going to be a great firewall around Europe that will prevent citizens within the EU from knowing what people outside the EU know? Will sites like Wikipedia, which don't necessarily have a presence in any particular country outside the US, will they have to comply as well? Our own privacy commissioner, not the current one, the previous one, called for a borderless service from Google to remove the information wherever you are. Now, meanwhile, back in Hong Kong in 2013, there was a smartphone app called Do No Evil, which is also happens to be a motto of Google, and they won the ICT Awards, the Best Lifestyle Silver Award for the innovation of their app. It's ironic we have now an Innovation and Technology Bureau, but you'll see what happened next. What their app was doing was collecting public domain data from judgments, bankruptcy notices, companies' registry filings, and so on, putting it all together, indexing it, and basically democratizing due diligence. Banks do this all the time on the Know Your Client rules, they have to. Companies do this regularly, checking up on the creditworthiness of small and medium enterprises and the people behind them. But they opened this functionality up to the general public. And for that, they won the Silver Award. And the whole award system, incidentally, is steered by the Office of the Government Chief Information Officer, and the judging panel includes a member of the government's efficiency unit. So what could be better recommendation than that award? Well, the Privacy Commissioner thought this was a bad thing and shut them down. He issued an enforcement notice and told them to cease and desist operating their application. Anyone, of course, if they put in the same effort that this company did, could collect the same information when it's available, and they could compile it themselves. All that this company did was to make it easier to get. So I think that it was the commissioner that was doing the evil in this case. The judging panel in the awards said that the app integrates an extensive database with a highly user-friendly search engine, allowing users to easily conduct legal background search. Before you let your apartment to a new tenant, you might want to check if they'd had any disputes with their previous landlords in the courts. The commissioner said the name search function and user-friendliness of the app allows its subscribers to access information of any particular individual indiscriminately, and this is a bad thing. Singapore has recently introduced its own privacy legislation, effective in July of 2014, and it defines publicly available personal data and completely exempts that from the scope of its law. Now, you might not associate Singapore and freedom of speech together, but clearly in this case, they've done the right thing. They've made it clear that if you did obtain it from a public source, then you're entitled to use it, process it, compile it in any way that you want. In Hong Kong's case, I think that it's implicit from the common sense understanding of the law that we can't all be data collectors, we can't all be data users in the in the parlance of the law, and subject to the data protection privacy principles. Otherwise, I could walk around to you and say, you've been reading about my share dealings in the newspaper, and I hear you've got clippings, and I hear you're keeping a file and trying to copy my investments. How long do you intend to keep that? You're a data user. Are you using it for the purpose for which it was published, or a different purpose? Are you calculating how much I'm worth? That's a different purpose. Newspapers like to do that with disclosures of my shareholdings. So I don't think that the law intended that once the data was public, that it's still subject to the law. Now, there's one other thing I should mention, which is a case involving Ming Pao in 2007. They collected information from a court writ filed against several newspapers, including themselves. So the writ was filed in order to sue the newspapers, not for the purposes of writing stories about the writ. But the Administrative Appeals Board held that the purpose adopted by Ming Pao is what mattered. Their purpose was reporting and publication. So they collected the data, they were consistent in that purpose when they reported it, and there was no breach of the ordinance. And now we come on to the case that I've been involved with for a couple of years now. Since 1998, the website.com has been collecting all sorts of public domain information, including thousands of judgments and regulatory sanctions and prosecutions and so forth. These things get logged on the website. We report on them, sometimes at great length, other times just a brief mention of the judgment, the parties involved, the date of the judgment, and a link so that people can read it for themselves. And in 2000 and 2001, there were three judgments following open public hearings in the Court of Appeal and Court of Final Appeal in a matrimonial case, and the three judgments were published online, including all the names of the parties. There was no secrecy in that. And I later saw these judgments and reported them on website reports, website.com. One of the parties involved, Luciana Wong, is a member of several statutory bodies which are covered by website Who's Who. We cover about 500 statutory and advisory bodies and their memberships in Hong Kong. Now, about 10 years after these judgments had been published fully in the open, she complained to the judiciary that her name was now online in these judgments and asked them to redact the names. And the judiciary agreed to do that. So that they were replaced with anonymous initials. And then she contacted website and said, would we redact our archive so that the names don't appear on our reports of the judgments either? And I said, no. Thank you for asking, but no. We don't self-censor. We're not going to decide what the public should know of what we know. We're not going to act if we're the last place on the internet that has this stuff, and we're not, by the way. We're not going to act as a gatekeeper on public domain information. So she complained to the Privacy Commissioner, who then issued, after an investigation, an enforcement notice ordering us to redact these judgments. And unlike Do No Evil, I decided that there's enough of a public interest concern about this that I shouldn't just cave in and do what he says. I should appeal. I don't make any money off this site, by the way. I pay for it. It's a charity to Hong Kong. It costs quite a bit of money to keep the information coming into the site and publishing it. So I appealed, and my appeal was rejected in October of last year. And the decision, whilst referring to the Ming Pao case of 2007, they said that they thought that was right, but in this case, it wasn't the purpose of website in collecting the data that matters, unlike Ming Pao. It was the purpose of the judiciary in collecting the data from the parties and publishing judgments that matters. And they said, very importantly, we do not believe that the appellant's purpose, that's me, the appellant, of using the complainant's personal data, i.e. reporting and publication for general use, can be said to be consistent with the judiciary's purposes of publishing the judgments, which they think is only for legal precedents and points of law. If that's the case, why is it that the general public has access to this website full of judgments? Why don't you have a password, restrict lawyers who have to sign in and agree not to publicize the contents of the judgments? Clearly, if what they say is true, that general reporting of judgments is a different purpose to the judiciary's purpose, then anything that you report as journalists about living people in court judgments, whether it's a matrimonial case, a bankruptcy case, litigation, criminal appeals, reasons for sentences, and so on. All of that is subject to the privacy ordinance, and you may be asked or ordered now or in the future to remove it from your reports or from your archives. That leaves me, if this notice and this judgment, this appeal decision stands, it leaves me in possession of public information that I can no longer tell you, either one-to-one or on my website. And I have an increasing store of information that I've collected that, under the interpretation of this decision, I am no longer allowed to tell you. Now, I mentioned the necessity of a restriction on free speech in the Basic Law. It's necessary to restrict you from standing up and inciting violence, for example, if there's an imminent threat. It's necessary to restrict you from libeling people and defaming people by saying things which are not true about them, and there's a civil remedy for that. But in HKSAR versus Lung Kwok Hung in the Court of Final Appeal last year, they clearly laid out that this must be no more than is necessary to accomplish the legitimate purpose in question. Now, the purpose in this case, in my case, and in the Do No Evil case, the purported purpose is to make the public information private again, to make it inaccessible. But I don't see how it can come even close to accomplishing that purpose if you can access the information on overseas websites. One of the judgments that I reported is still available, guess where, on a mainland website. If publishers overseas can collect information from Hong Kong judiciary, companies registry, land registry, and so on, if they can publish it freely in Singapore or in the United States or anywhere that allows this, then basically all that the restriction does is not to accomplish its objective, but to put Hong Kong publishers at a disadvantage, at a competitive disadvantage. It also begs the question, then, should we block these overseas publishers from collecting the information in Hong Kong by monitoring their IP addresses? And should we block people in Hong Kong from accessing the information on overseas websites if they haven't got the common sense to get themselves a VPN, like some people in China get? Do we really want to create a great firewall of Hong Kong like the great firewall of China? Because if we're not going to do that, then I can't see how we can get close to accomplishing the objective, and that makes the restriction imposed by this enforcement notice against us, against Do No Evil, it makes that restriction unconstitutional. It just doesn't achieve what it sets out to achieve. The appeal board's only reference to this question was that, don't worry, because the commissioner, the privacy commissioner, will carry out a balancing exercise. He will decide whether there's a public interest in the information that you've published and whether you should be required to take it down. Well, that's all very well for people in Hong Kong like me, but it won't affect the overseas publishers. It doesn't address that constitutional necessity question. So if this stands, then, as I said, you all as journalists and your publishers may face action for not removing old articles or even current articles about private matters that you've reported in the courts. You may have been sitting in the Court of Appeal listening to a high-profile divorce involving hundreds of millions of dollars in awards, but if you come out of the courtroom and report it, even though there's no court restriction, the Privacy Commissioner may seek to restrict you from publishing that. Likewise, in the cases of convictions and old bankruptcy notices. I don't think that the Hong Kong media, or indeed any print media around the world today, has the resources that Google has to run takedown departments to deal with an endless stream of requests from people to remove their embarrassing information before they run for public office or whatever. So the simple answer to that is then it's cheaper to close your archive to prevent people from looking back at the history, and at the most just have to deal with current requests from the Privacy Commissioner not to report personal data. And we're probably going to continue then with paywalls on the land registry and on the companies registry, and a continued stifling of innovation in the big data and public data space. Now, archives are actually already being shrunk, and I've been unable to get an answer from the Hong Kong Standard as to why they've done this, but in 2013, the same year that the Privacy Commissioner ordered Do No Evil to stop indexing old judgments and bankruptcy notices and so on, the Hong Kong Standard shrank its archive. You could look back to 1995, and this page is from archive.org, which takes snapshots of the internet as time goes by. 18th of May, 2013, you could look back. What happened? 12 days later, it looks like this. You can only look back 3 years. And if you go there today, you can only look back not to 2010, but to 2013, which is the third full year back from where we are today. As I say, I can't prove that this is anything to do with the Privacy Commissioner, but to me, it rather sucks. The idea that I can't now search the Hong Kong Standards archive to look at coverage of, for example, the Express Rail Link financing in 2009, when there was a huge political battle over whether or not the $65 billion scheme, as it was then, should go ahead. And that's the big picture of Hong Kong and the situation of freedom of speech here. I'd be very happy to take any questions that come from this. Thanks.
Thank you very much, David. Is there any further legal remedy for you to try to unseal the Luciana Wong files, or does the AAB decision effectively end your legal remedies to try to be able to restore that information?
Yeah. There's no right of appeal in the AAB process. They are the appellate board for the Privacy Commissioner's decisions. But one always has in Hong Kong the right of judicial review, something that Geoffrey Ma reminded of us yesterday. So there is a potential within a short period of time to launch a judicial review of the board's decision or the Privacy Commissioner's decision or both. As I said before, I have no financial interest in any of this. The only reason I brought the appeal was to try and thrash out the issues and hopefully get a favorable decision that would free this cloud of uncertainty over what you can do with public data in Hong Kong. I didn't get that. So if I'm going to take a JR forward, it would have to be with full commitment from pro bono senior barristers with expertise in constitutional law, because I'm not a lawyer. I can't do much more heavy lifting on this. It has to be up to the legal community to decide for themselves whether at this point in time and with this particular case, whether it's a good enough example to test the law in court. Alternatively, there might be future enforcement notices against me or against some other publisher involving public domain data, where perhaps it's not clouded by the somewhat religious issues about divorce that might cloud judgments in this particular example. So it's a possibility, but I can't say more than that at this stage.
I've never forgotten a case several years ago in which one of the banks was about to do an IPO here. And one of the main sponsors of the company was somebody whom they realized there was somebody with the same English name who had been in a fraud case. They asked the individual and they said, "Oh, that's not me." And they couldn't look up in Shanghai whether it was the same individual, but they were able to look up in Hong Kong and they found that in fact it was the same person and the IPO was pulled. As you've seen this blanket of silence in so many areas of privacy, including financial data, descending. One, have the banks said much about it? Have they said enough about it in your view? And two, do you think the opportunities to defraud retail investors in Hong Kong are increasing?
They've never been so good, have they? There is
opportunities to defraud, you mean?
Yes, yes. there is a constant stream of frauds that emerge from an emerging market like China. Transparency and sunshine is the best disinfectant, and that means having the ability as much as possible for as many people as possible to scrutinize the affairs of companies, of businesses, and of government. And the more that we have access restricted, and as I mentioned, you know, if someone closes off, a publisher closes off access to their archives simply to make it cheaper to run their publication, they don't just close off access to the personal data in the archive, but to all of the archive, all of the political debates, all of the business affairs, all of the history of different companies and so on as well. So all of these issues are interrelated, Hong Kong needs to, if it wants to build on its hard-won reputation for the rule of law, it needs to move forward with greater transparency and not backward by extending the very good purposes of the privacy ordinance into the public domain in this way.
But have the banks said much?
The banks have not been at all vocal on this, nor are they ever vocal in corporate governance matters, because not only do they manage hundreds of billions of dollars worth of MPF money, but they also do business with the businesses with the companies as well. So they don't tend to go very public on these issues.
Exactly. Let me open the floor for more questions. Back here, please.
Yes. Hi, David. Jane Singer here.
Hi, Jane.
Nice to see you. This was a very interesting presentation, and I do follow your website email reports that you send out. With regard to privacy, clearly certain things are public data, but where do you see the line blurred between public and private? I mean, is there a potential for that to become, not all the time, but for people to misuse that? Particularly, I mean, do you feel that perhaps public things private matters regarding public people, where do you draw the line on privacy for people?
Well, I think that if the information has been made public because of some law, like the company's ordinance, for example, that's been done after proper process in passing the legislation in the first place. And you opt into that process when you become a company director. If it's been made public after a public court of appeal or court of final appeal hearing, not one where there were privacy orders given at the outset, as there are for rape victims, for example, then it's public information. If on the other hand, the case has been heard in private, adoption proceedings would be another one, where it's quite clear that there is a prohibition on reporting, even if you happen to know what's going on, then that clearly is in the private domain. And the only area where you have to think hard about the consequences is if there is an accidental or intentful data leak. For example, a few years back, I discovered the entire database of the complaints against police office and the Independent Police Complaints Council had been accidentally, by a service provider of the IPCC, had been put online. Now, I didn't go and publish a whole copy of that or use any of the data inside it. I made sure that the issue became, that the media were aware of the issue. And the site was taken offline, and there was no, to my knowledge, no abuse of that data. And so clearly, if you get a data leak that involves financial data, for example, unless it exposes criminality or corruption, for example, if the bank statements of a politician are leaked online and it shows that they've been on the take, then there's a public interest that overrides that privacy. But otherwise, I would say leave the private data alone and don't exploit private data if it accidentally or intentionally is put online.
Right. Okay. Thank you.
Over here, please.
Hi, David.
Hi, John.
Continuing our conversation. John Baconshone. So the thing I find missing from your talk, I mean, there are many things I agree with. I agree the commissioner got Do No Evil seriously wrong, because if all you're doing is making the same information available in an app, which is available at the same time and from a public source, that clearly cannot be a problem. But my difficulty is you don't mention rehabilitation anywhere in the presentation. And I think the problem is that the Google decision, flawed though it was in many ways, was essentially about the right of rehabilitation, not the right to be forgotten. We have laws for rehabilitation, which used to make sense in the days before the internet, but they don't necessarily make sense anymore. The other concern I have is that, you see, you were sort of just in your previous answer talking about the distinction between what was intentionally public and what wasn't. Now, the case that you took the commissioner to court about was specifically actually about a situation where the judiciary has now accepted that the information should not have been available. So in the case of family court decisions, they now accept they should be anonymized. So I don't believe there was ever an explicit decision saying that family courts should not have been anonymized originally. They just never thought about it properly. So that arguably was a weakness on the part of the judiciary. So I think the problem is that what seemed to be okay in the past in terms of making information public often wasn't carefully thought through. In fact, if you read the original report that led to the setting up of the Data Protection Ordinance, it said very clearly that the government should go through all the public data sets and reflect on what the appropriate purpose was of making those data sets public. The government failed to do that, and that, I think, has led to many of these problems. And in the case of the company's ordinance, clearly you don't agree with what they thought the purpose should be, but that should have been dealt with a long, long time ago. And I do think there is a case for the fact even now the judiciary still doesn't have proper purposes stated on their website, which I consider to be a massive failing on the part of judiciary. We don't necessarily all have to agree what the purposes should be, but I think they do need to be made explicit. Thank you.
We've now reached 2 o'clock, but if you can try to briefly ask that. Okay, I apologize, I see some people
there
checking
are two
their
questions.
Watches.
There are two questions there, and if you have a meeting to get to, feel free to leave. I won't be mad at you, I won't publish your name. The first one is on the rehabilitation of offenders ordinance. That's the only law I'm aware of that you're referring to in relation to rehabilitation. But what the purpose of that really is to make sure that you have a second chance after a relatively modest, in Hong Kong's case, 3 months jail sentence or $10,000 fine, nothing more than that. If you don't reoffend for 3 years, then it can't be held against you for employment in Hong Kong, except in certain professions, including being a barrister in any licensed profession, and that would include construction workers, estate agents, SFC licensed persons, accountants. There's a whole raft of professions which are now licensed, in which case it can be held against you in licensing decisions. And so it's not that your conviction didn't happen. It's not that the South China Morning Post should remove the coverage of that conviction from its archives. It's simply that if you're applying for employment in Hong Kong, it can't be held against you, and also that public officers, when asked in certain circumstances, don't have to disclose it. And you can say, I don't have convictions, if you're asked by an employer. But if they find it in the Morning Post archive or somewhere else, they're entitled to know that fact. They just can't hold it against you. I don't think that you can sort of unwind the disclosure that's already happened in the case if it's been a public case. And then in the case that you mentioned, the cases I reported, these were after open appeal hearings in the Court of Appeal and Court of Final Appeal, not the Court of First Instance. Any reporter sitting there at the time could have written an article that would remain in their archives today. Just so happens that they didn't. I think there might have been more to say on that in my case if there had been other reports in other archives. And policies change over time, yes, but if there wasn't a court order in the first place prohibiting reporting of the case, then it shouldn't be illegal for people who have that information, who read the judgments in the open, to tell other people about it. And you simply can't reverse that arrow of time. You can't impose retrospectively new legislation or new policies on old acts. So that would be my answer to the second question.
Thank you very much. Are you able to stay a few more minutes? I can
sure.
see a couple more hands up, but at the same time, we do promise our members that we'll let people go at 2 o'clock. Can people, maybe if you can come up and speak with David afterwards. Thank you all. We always try to give our guests something to remember the club by. Here you go, David, and let's all give him a big hand. Thank you.